Welcome to the Leave No Doubt podcast. I'm glad to have Mark Sampson joining us today. Just before we get started, I'd like to thank our episode sponsors, Connection Technologies, specialists in telecom and IT services. So please check them out. For those of you who might not know, just like a brief introduction to Mark. Mark's a obviously a successful football coach, working in the boys game at Swansea Academy, before moving into the women's game with Bristol Academy, the England Lionesses, and then Stevenage in the men's game. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Dan. Great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
No problem. Yeah, I thought, Mark, it was a really great opportunity to get yourself on the podcast and, you know, share your insights, you know, really broad insights from, you know, both sides of the game, youth, senior players. To kick us off, I just want to start with, you know, where your career, your coaching career started out and Swansea Academy. You know, Swansea have always had a history or a legacy of, you know, bringing through great coaches, having great managers, having that style of play. What was it, or is there anything from that time that helped, like, you know, develop you as a coach early on?
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, Swansea, like any club, you understand the area and the culture of the club as early as possible. And at Swansea, you know, the local players in Swansea, the culture is very much hardworking, robust, tough. So they'd always reflect that in their training and matches. You know, every time they would play a game or a training session, they'd like to compete. What tended to change then at the time I was there was Roberto Martins came to the club and he added that extra bit of culture, bit of flair, that focus on the technical side of the game. And when you bring them together, you know, you've really got a chance of developing some talented players when you've got the mindset to be competitive and want to compete and want to work and want to get better every day, combined with the composure to apply some of the technical qualities that were required with that style of play, you know, you're really starting to look at developing rounded players then.
Yeah, brilliant. And, you know, in those times, you know, obviously an academy has a transition. Was it a case of working and developing the players that were already inside the building, or were they starting to look for players with different technical qualities that they could bring in to suit the actual style?
Yeah, good question. And do you know what? There's actually a really good example, which I think is the best way to describe it, is that Joe Allen, so Joe's gone on to win nearly 100 caps for Wales, has made well over a few hundred appearances in the Championship for Swansea and other clubs, and made his big move probably to Liverpool, the Premier League, under Brendan Rodgers. And Joe's a really good example. You know, Joe was a first year scholar when I joined the club, and for his first year he played well. You know, every game he'd do well in that under 18 environment. But the manager at the time had a very different style of play and vision of the game. You know, and nothing's right or wrong in football, but the way the first team played then was about moving the ball forward quickly, competing for second balls and putting the ball in the box and being effective at set plays. So size and athleticism was super important. And for those who don't know Joe's, you know, 5'5", probably 10K soaking wet, but very, very technical. You know, if you're giving the ball in a high pressurized situation, you'll find a way to pick a pass, normally a good forward pass. But the way the first team was playing, it just wasn't going to fit into that way of playing. So, you know, Joe was told at the end of his first year of a scholar, and he had a year left on his contract, that his contract wouldn't be renewed. He wouldn't be offered a professional deal. So he started looking for other clubs. Just so happened then in November the following season, Roberto Martinez came in and took over. And obviously then is a complete shift in the quality and type of player, the profile of player the club are looking for. And literally within a week, Joe was training with the first team. Within 10 days, he made his first team debut. And obviously the rest is history. So I think, you know, often as a player, it's important to understand what your qualities are and really focus in on them. You know, Joe is a great example of not trying to be 7 out of 10 everything, but really making sure that those two or three qualities he was as good as he could be in them. And then when he was, and he found the right environment, the success followed.
Yeah, I guess that's really, really, really powerful advice, isn't it? Like matching, you know, what you are as a player to the environment that you're in. Do you think that's possibly more important than adapting to the environment that you're in? You know, if like you aren't necessarily a technical player, but you understand that where you are to get into the first team, you're going to have to become technical. Is that also another route you can take?
Yeah, for sure. I think you've ultimately got to work out as a player, given the qualities you've got, how can you be effective? You know, you're doing that every Saturday anyway. You know, you're competing. So you're really thinking about how can I find a way to win for the team, but also win for myself? How can I make as much impact as possible on this game, given the qualities I've got? You know, let's go back to that Joe example. You know, Joe would know if he came up against a big, strong, athletic, powerful physical opponent, he would have to find a way to, you know, manipulate the ball quickly, find spaces where he could get faced up and play forward and be smart defensively. You know, probably not go and compete in those 50-50 duels, but work out how he can intercept a pass or how could he position himself to react better to a second ball and pick it up. So he's still being effective in the game, but he's playing to his strengths rather than the opponent's strengths.
Yeah, that's something I think we spoke about. I think back to one of our earliest podcasts where we had a player called Stuart Sinclair. And Stuart, for those of you who might not listen to this one yet, it's a really interesting podcast because Stuart didn't actually make his Football League debut until the age of 29. You know, so he's played non-league football for, you know, the vast majority of his career. And he spoke about, you know, and Stuart is obviously a small player as well, but he spoke about being effective as a player. So I think that's some really good advice to, to look at and share and try and think about your own game. I just wanted to touch on, so during this time, you started being manager of a Tafswell. So Tafswell being a Welsh league team, obviously not necessarily as much of a professional setup. What is it, do you think, what advice can you give to players at that level that want to become better players, you know, even, you know, at that level?
Mm. No, good question. Look, the semi-professional space is a challenging space because, you know, naturally players have got full-time jobs in the main and they're fitting their football around their daily activities, you know, family, profession. But there might still be some ambition to go and play higher within the semi-professional game or even get themselves into the professional game at some point. And I think from my experience at that level, of both a player and a coach, is that your ball time is limited. You're obviously a professional player, you're getting to compete against your teammates with the ball for roughly, let's say, an hour a day on average. You know, if you've got a day off, so 90 minutes, whatever it might be, an hour a day, let's say. So you're probably getting 1,000 touches a day as a professional player. And, you know, when that, you calculate that, that's 5,000 a week, 20,000 a month. You know, it's a lot of touches compared to a semi-professional player who might only be getting probably a maximum of 2 sessions a week. So if he's lucky, he's getting 200, 300 touches per week on the ball. You're already 700 touches down a week on a professional player. So I think for a semi-professional player, how I always looked at it, and I think the best advice is that training time, the ball time, the game understanding stuff is super important. So do the physical work away from the teamwork. You know, if you can make sure that actually when I turn up at a team training, I'm already in great physical condition, I can really focus now on touches of the ball, manipulating the ball, whatever I need to do to be effective within my game, then also the game understanding piece, then I'm at least giving myself a platform to maximize the training with the team. So that would definitely be the advice. And that was always the advice I would give to the players at that level. Look, it's not my responsibility to get you to a physical level. I haven't got time for that. We've got to work on helping you improve with the skills you need to play in your position. And also as a team, understanding how we want to play. So away from training, you know, you need to really focus in on making sure you're the best level of athlete you can possibly be.
Yeah, no, great advice, and definitely something, you know, players taking that ownership and responsibility on themselves. You know, you want to be able to remove the excuse, I guess, from the manager's mind. You know, you need to be turning up in that best state of conditioning, and that onus essentially, I guess, at that level falls upon you. And the benefit you get from that is that, you know, those training sessions, you can actually focus on just becoming, I guess, a better footballer. So progressing, I guess, quickly, and something I was really keen to get on to, because, you know, with the relevance of the women's game of just recently, we've just had the World Cup, and obviously it's, you know, doing really, really well at the moment, all over the news. You moved to Bristol Academy. I think that's the name before it became a Bristol City Academy, Bristol City women's team. What was it about moving to Bristol Academy at this time that, you know, excited you, or what made you make the move into the women's game? Because I guess it wasn't as established as it is now.
No, it wasn't. I think, yeah, like most people probably, like simple economics, you know, looking at, you know, what's best for your economic situation, personally, professionally. But then also it was probably my first opportunity to be the leader, really, of the ship. You know, at Swansea, I was the Centre of Excellence Director, but reported to a head of youth, reported to a first team manager. You know, you're bound by certain criteria, really. But at Bristol, there was an opportunity to lead a programme, you know, be the leader of the youth section, and then obviously lead the first team as well. And there was at the time, the game was moving to a more professional direction with the Super League. You know, it made sense. And for me, I've always been keen to test myself with something new, and it was a new experience. You know, I had the taste of TAS well. I enjoyed it, and that was something at Bristol I wanted to do, really, to go in and become a head coach and ultimately be the person who makes the decisions, the final call, really, on the direction of travel for the team and the club.
I'm thinking back to your time and, you know, going into Bristol Academy, going into women's football. Was there anything that stood out with, you know, you and how you maybe had to adapt as a coach to working in the female game?
Look, for sure. You know, I think the first thing to say on that is that not much. You know, there's not a massive difference. I think anyone should fear the move either way, moving from the female game to the male game or male game to the female game. But for sure, there's differences you need to be aware of. And like any new role, really, you know, I think it's important to remember that old school bit of advice that, you know, you've got two ears and one mouth for a reason. So I think when you go into a new role, you need to have the humility to listen a lot, to try and understand how that team operates, what's been going well, where you could potentially add value and make some changes. And that's probably been advice I've taken to every role I've gone into, is understand that although you've got your own ideas, a lot of the time there's a lot of good work that's gone on. Even if you take on a difficult situation, there's probably still a lot of areas within that team that are actually very, very good, but a couple of things that have held them back. So I think for sure, you know, players, coaches, it's important to respect, be humble going to that new environment, and take it upon yourself to adapt to that environment, not necessarily assuming that everyone has to adapt to you.
No, that's brilliant advice. So during your time at Bristol Academy, you know, really a successful period there. I think you finished second in the WSL in 2013. You reached two FA Cup finals in 2011 and 2013 again. You know, what was it about that team at the time that helped them become so successful, probably a club that was less resourced than some of the other teams in the league at the time?
Yeah, less resourced, to say the least. You know, probably a quarter of the budget of some of the competitors in every area, you know, facilities, equipment, travel, and obviously salaries. And look, I think it's that again, that famous old saying of a team is that, you know, when you get the chemistry right, everyone adds value to each other. So by me and you playing in midfield, Dan, this wouldn't be the case, but let's pretend it would be. By me and you playing together in midfield, yeah, we might be 5 out of 10 players. So between us, we're 10 out of 20. But our chemistry when we play together makes us 8 out of 10 players. So suddenly we're a 16 out of 20 unit. And that was certainly the case at Bristol. You know, the group of players we had, their strengths supplemented each other. So the right back playing next to the right midfield player, you know, the right back strengths playing the strengths of the right midfield players. And then you add that up over the course of a team, makes a real big difference, you know, in, and also the humility of the team to do the things we talked about earlier. Like, they were incredibly fit. They were super, super fit, you know, and we weren't professional at the time. So that rule of you take it upon yourself to look after your physicality, you know, they took that the next level. You know, the players could run from minute one to minute 95. And we used that as our superpower, really. You know, the team was built around being fit, robust, relentless. And those, that combination of those factors, you know, probably allowed us to achieve, get results that on paper we really shouldn't have.
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions on that one. And just going, like, diving into, you know, the training. What did training look like, you know, back then? You know, was there anything in it that helped these players to become fit, or was it stuff that they did outside from training?
Good question. No, look, I think we ultimately decided, like any job, you know, you take over a role, and it's probably important for players to be aware of that. I think a lot of coaches will go, right, well, you know, this is where we are now. We've got to get to here. If we keep doing the things we've done, we're going to get what we've always got. Maybe with a fresh face, we might improve a little bit, or might even get worse. So what are we going to do significantly different that moves us from there to there, that pushes that needle significantly? And I think we identified our USP as being that physical piece, you know, really improving us physically. And we also felt that if we could keep the tactical structure simple and consistent, we wouldn't need to spend a lot of time working on that side of the game. So probably after a season, we realized, right, this is the way to play. This is what gets the best out of our players. We then focused on the competitive element. So really what we describe as finding ways to win. So smelling a game, I call it. So the team were brilliant at, you know, in managing momentum. That if we were playing an Arsenal, for example, we knew that, you know, for 80 minutes of that game, probably 85, we're going to suffer. We're going to be, you know, not having much of the ball, asked a lot of questions defensively. But we knew for a 5 or 10 minute spell in that game, we would have we'd be able to dictate to them. And the team were brilliant at smelling the game. They'd know when to accept that we're up against it. Let's be solid. Let's work hard. Let's control the opposition. And at the times where you could, you know, go for the throat, really, you could really go, right, this is our chance now to score a goal, to dictate. And that was probably the team's superpowers. And we would spend a lot of time in training talking about that situation, recreating that situation. You know, we played 4-4-2 standard, and we'd often play even 15 players against 9, you know, so the 9 would have two banks of 4, a goalkeeper, and the other team would have 15 players, and it would be, right, 20 minutes, how are you going to find a way to win, you team of 9? And all those, that work on a consistent basis developed the, what we call the heart and the head. You know, the technical piece is what it is, but the heart and the head, suddenly then it was a team thing. You know, we had the same heart, the same head. We could see the game as a collective and then make decisions as a collective.
Welcome to the Leave No Doubt podcast. I'm so excited to welcome our new sponsors, Connection Technologies, a market leader in business-to-business tools ranging from business mobile, hosted telephony, and fixed line services. Head over to their website at www.connection-technologies.co.uk, fill in their inquiry web form and find out how Connection Technologies can support your business moving forward.
One of the things you spoke about was, like, players having the connection, or, you know, you understanding the strengths and weaknesses from within the team or the team units. Was this something that, you know, you did on the pitch or off the pitch, or, you know, how did you get the players to understand what their strengths were or what the strengths of the person playing with them was.
Yeah, good point. I think, look, let's relate it back to players. Even now in this day, it's still the case that if you probably tallied up, if a player joins an academy at the age of 8, let's say, and they're released at the age of 18, they have a 10-year experience. If we could tally up all the information they would get within that environment, one, it would like fill 1,000 books, you know, technical information, physical information, lifestyle, behavior, all, and that's just football, let alone all the other things that go in their life. And then if we went, how much of it is positive reinforcement versus constructive feedback at best, probably criticism, I'd estimate we're probably still at 80-20, maybe even 90-10. You know, 90% of the information the player's getting is, this is what you need to do to get better. This is what you're not very good at. You've got to do this better. And I think at that club, we try to flip that percentage. You know, we try to reinforce a player's qualities 90% of the time with tips on how to even impact, put your qualities on the game even more. So even when we were giving constructive feedback, it was related to not what you're not doing or what you're not good at. It was, if you do this, you can do what you're good at even better and even more. And I think that was important. You know, bite your tongue as a coach and focus on reinforcing. If we've got a right, and we did have a right back who was, you know, brilliant for us at getting forward, the right midfield player would narrow up as an extra centre field player, allow the right back to get up and down the field. Probably like 90% of the time, all we would do as a staff would talk to her about, you know, brilliant, you know, great run that, love that overlap. You can you overlap again? So I think it's important to reinforce it, but also as a player, to have that positive self-talk to reinforce it to yourself, you know, to accept that, look, there's bits of my game I'm not good at, but I'm really going to remind myself of the things I'm good at and find opportunity to do them again and again and again.
Yeah, and definitely something for, you know, the listeners listening to, you know, work out what is your super strength and what is it that you are brilliant at, what gets you in the team, and then, you know, make sure you are doing that. And I guess that becomes the effectiveness as a player. You're in there for a reason and that's what you're really good at. So moving on, you moved from, obviously, after a successful period at the Bristol Academy, you moved to England, a team... obviously, like, you know, fantastic, the Lionesses, we're all seeing what they're doing at this moment in time, but I think the landscape was a little bit different. They'd been with Hope Powell for a long time, and then you're coming in as a new manager, taking over. What were your, I guess, first impressions when going into that England setup with the players and where the game was at that moment in time?
Look, I think probably go back to the previous point we had around starting a new job, is that you're quickly trying to work out, right, the team's 11th in the world. It's been just knocked out at a group stage of a major tournament without winning a game. How are you going to move from getting knocked out of the group to get into semi-finals and finals? How are you going to move from 11th in the world to consistently top three in the world? And ultimately, you have got to do something different. So I think we probably quickly realised that the big gap in the team was the mentality, really, was, you know, the players, they were a nice team. You know, like they play against teams, and I think everyone enjoyed at that time playing against England. England had a very clear tactical structure. So as an opponent, you know how they're going to play. That's one tick. Yeah, they would follow that plan relentlessly, so nothing would change. So we knew if we get on top of them, we find a way to beat that way of playing, we're probably going to find a way to win. And the third piece was that the players probably didn't have that mentality to, like, we're going to win. It was very much like, you know, well, once things didn't go up, we'd be optimistic going into a game, but once things started going against us, it was like, well, you know what, then... that's the way it is. We'll write this one off and on to the next one. So I think the big gap was around the mentality of the team, you know, trying to encourage and develop the players' mindset that, you know, we're here to win. We're here to compete. And, you know, we need to win. And that was a long process, but I think that was the USP. How can we move this team from being winning mindset 3 out of 10 to winning mindset 10 out of 10? And that takes a lot of work collectively, but also individually from the players as well.
Yeah, brilliant. And, you know, I guess just giving a little insight into what did women's game look like at this moment in time? You know, obviously they hadn't long been professional. I guess WSL had only been going very recently. What was the development curve that the women's game was on at that moment in time?
It was interesting in terms of the game had moved to a professional, and actually the facts were telling us that the players were fitness, for example, had decreased, which seems stupid because you're thinking, well, I'm going from semi-professional to professional. You'd have thought everything really would start to go on upward curve. But, you know, at the time, and you'll be aware of this with your background, you know, when you're a semi-professional player, and these players were the best of the best, so they, you know, they were incredibly motivated. They were pretty much taking responsibility a lot of the time for their physical condition. There was no sports scientist to manage their minutes, manage their load, manage their nutrition. They just did it and took it upon themselves to follow guidelines. And you know, you're on your own, you're running around a field. You either push it as far as you can or you don't. And what we had to do was really try and bring the semi-pro mindset into professional game. So how can we keep the qualities of semi-professional but have that in the professional setting? So it was a lot about, you know, encouraging the sports scientists that let's see how far they can push themselves. Let's not set boundaries for them. Let's see what they can do. You know, if we're going to set bars and challenges, let's set them right up there, which are probably unattainable, but let's see how far they push themselves. And I think that was one of the big challenges, was trying to move from take the good things about the semi-professional game into the professional game, because you'd have seen it as well. Sometimes in a professional game, you know, let's call a spade, people are quite lazy. You know, like they turn up at 10 o'clock, do a bit of training, have a bit of lunch, token gesture if you lift in the gym, and off they go. And we had to like change that mindset. We had to be right. Well, we're taking the hard work you were doing for 2 hours a day as semi-professional. We're going to repeat that hard work, but now we're doing it for 6 hours a day. And that was hard to move that mindset and mentality across both staff and players.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. It's that whole case of, you know, sometimes when players in professional setups or the players are in first team setups, you know, the assumption might be for those players that, you know, if I do everything that you tell me to do, then I'm going to become a better player, or all I need to do is what you're telling me to do. I think one of the best pieces of advice I can give to players is, you know, actually you maximize every minute that you are within that setup. You know, I've experienced it with players before that they come in, they do the gym, you know, are they really trying? Are they really giving their maximum, or are they just doing the gym to get the work done to go home? So, you know, actually there's often a purpose behind everything that happens in there, but it's players' responsibility to maximize what's going on, because ultimately it's their career if they're not doing it. So definitely, I think, you know, from my early experience and perception of the players at that time, from the semi-professional players, you know, I think there was a group of really hardworking players, you know, and transferring, like you say, what happens in that part time to the professional setup. So moving on, obviously England went from, I can remember, it was 11th or 12th in the world. And you've gone on to win the Cyprus Cup, and then at the first World Cup, reaching the semi-finals out in Canada. I'd love to, I guess, get an insight into, you know, what did that look like? What did that feel like? Was that part of a natural trajectory in terms of, you know, the success that you had at that tournament? Or was there some really standout moments, you know, that thought this really built the success for us in this period?
Yeah, look, you always, I think like a player, you know, teams and players, businesses, you need the odd bit of, you need to win the odd moment. You know, there's a few moments that you think, if we win this moment, then we're going to be able to go again. If we lose this moment, it's going to take us back a few steps. So the Cyprus Cup is one of those moments. You know, if the team hadn't won that final, won that tournament, I'm not sure we could have gone on to do what we did at the World Cup. You know, and I think I remember as a group of staff deciding that, you often as a coach, you're deciding, when do you put the pressure on the players? When you take the pressure off. And, you know, in that Cyprus Cup, we decided to put the pressure on. You know, a lot of the players who are listening will think about what's their most important quality. And I always say with players that the most important quality you can probably have is confidence. If you could take one quality, you'd say, can I always be confident? And with confidence, belief, those qualities need evidence. You know, your brain needs something to say, right, you think you're good, but is there any evidence out there to reinforce the fact that maybe we are good? And on that Cyprus Cup, you know, we challenged the players, say, look, if we're realistic about getting past the quarterfinal, getting to a quarterfinal of a World Cup, let alone winning it, we have to win this tournament. We have to. And once we won it then, you know that reinforcement from that fact that you've won that tournament is starting to tell you, well, do you know what? We've now won this one, so why can't we go win a World Cup? So I just think, you know, sometimes as a player, as a coach, you've got to put pressure on yourself and also go out there and actively seek the evidence to reinforce the belief you need in yourself and as a collective to go and achieve something.
Because I guess at this moment in time, like, England had never got out of the group stages at a World Cup. You know, this was all very new for these players. So, you know, you're able to give them that confidence to, you know, we are going to take this next step. For those, I think if I look back to this moment in time, and it might have just been for me, but this was the kind of the time where, you know, everyone started to get a little bit excited about the women's team at tournaments. You know, there was a lot of hype around the Canada, people, you know, watching it. Obviously, it was a different time zones at the time, but, you know, people, you know, getting up to watch these games. What does an international tournament look like for those of people who, you know, you might not have experienced one for a team and a player, and, you know, the journey that you went on throughout it?
Yeah, look, they're unique experiences, as you know. They're different to a calendar year as a club, where, you know, ultimately as a club, when you lose one game, you can recover from it. You know, you could even lose your first five games of the season and still go on to have an incredibly successful season as a club. Whereas obviously in a tournament setting, like the Champions League knockout stage, for example, you lose one game, you're out. And, you know, even the Champions League doesn't reflect the World Cup to that extent, because you might get a second leg to recover it. But at a World Cup, you know, you lose a quarterfinal game, no second chance, you go home. So I think preparing for that is important, you know, and the teams who do well in tournaments traditionally, and we've seen it in the recent World Cup, and England were a good example of that. You know, they had large spells where they were probably a long way from their best. But in those spells, they stayed in games and managed to then get over the line at the end of it. You know, sometimes you see teams who, you know, play brilliantly for three games, but then they have one off game and they can't find a way to stay in the tournament. So that's certainly like a quality teams need and players need in tournaments, is you need to be robust. You know, you've got World Cup is a 7-day event within a month. So how are you going to make sure that you're not only available for seven games, but as you go on, the games get harder? So how are you even mentally and physically, emotionally growing through the tournament that you actually peak the longer you stay in it? And they're very different challenges to what you face on a day-to-day basis at a club.
Yeah, and so just thinking like away from the football, like Canada, obviously a long way from home. You might not be, you know, in the same environment that you're used to, in the same environment that you're comfortable for. You know, how is it, or what qualities do players need, or how can how did you manage to create the environment around that to support the players and make sure that they were able to get the best out of them on the day?
Look, I think in those where you're privileged enough to work with like elite athletes, you know, in that environment, there was certainly a number of elite athletes. You understand this high performance line that is probably thrown around a lot at the moment is not for everyone. Like, you know, it's not for me. I know that for sure. You know, like I looked at some of the players, the Demi Stokes, the Lucy Bronze, the Rachel Dalys, Jodie Taylors, and I could name a lot more, Steph Hortons. Like you look at how they live their life and you understand that takes some high level of commitment. That's high performance. You know, like every minute of every day, there's a consideration about performance. You know, what they eat, how much they sleep, how much rest they get, stretching, the intensity they bring to every activity. You know, even a recovery session is done to the highest quality. You know, if Dan, as the fitness coach, says, you know, do this yoga position for 30 seconds, they do it for 32 seconds and they're in the perfect position. And if they're not, they tap you on the shoulder and say, why isn't this as right as it should? What do I need to change to make this better? So I think you understand you need those people around you. You need those high performance people who like just drive standards personally and then naturally collectively, because other people see them then and they notice that how they eat, how they conduct themselves around the place, how they train in the gym, in recovery session, on the grass. You know, they're the people that drive the standards. And what you do as a leader then is you pretty much just give them the rope to really say, go on in, you drive the culture within this team and give them the space to do it and then reinforce their behaviors with the rest of the group. So when the other players aren't living up to those standards, it's your job as a leader then to step in and say, look, these are the standards that we're setting. We need to up our game in these areas and support where needed.
Yeah, and I guess I hope it's not like an eye-opening for some players and some people out there, but just the understanding that being elite is hard, it's not easy. You know, it's going to require sacrifice, it's going to require a mindset, you know, a diligence. You know, there's certain definitely qualities you see in elite players that, you know, they don't necessarily get there by chance. You know, they've got there by just being consistent with the behaviors that they've worked on. You know, I think that's brilliant for anyone, you know, young players striving or looking, you know, actually understanding that if you aspire to be this, you know, it's not all going to be easy. It's not all going to be good. It's not all going to be like fun times. But you know, you will get the rewards from it on the back end.
As you know, Dan, is that it's a choice. You know, you have to understand that, like, if someone's forcing you to do it, it's never going to be the case that you're going to get those levels. You know, we all read books and listen to podcasts and watch TV and Netflix series about elite athletes and high performers, and we see all the nice bits. But, you know, those people made a choice that they're pretty much going to dedicate the majority of their life to being as good as they can be. And I think if you can accept that, or might even acknowledge that, well, I'm never going to get to that level. So this is the level I want to get to. That's what I can demand of myself, and keep yourself, you know, let's imagine above 80%, then you give yourself a chance. But I think to kid yourself that I want to be a high performer, but then really know that you're not able to deliver those standards on a consistent basis, is only going to actually make things worse for you and the people around you.
Yeah, brilliant. And just focusing in on, you know, I think there was a period with this time, or between, you know, the World Cup and the Euros, especially around, you know, that focus and drive on the physicality of the women's game. And there's lots of stats came out that, you know, tournament on tournament, the women's game is getting more and more physical. You know, like the running stats are going up by 30% each tournament, which, you know, is, you know, really high. Behind the scenes or within the actual group, there was this big, the physical push. And, you know, Why was that, or what was the benefits in that that you see at the time?
Look, the evidence was definitely one. Yeah, you alluded to that then. And, you know, obviously with physical development, in football, lots of things are subjective. You know, are you playing better? Well, there's some evidence to suggest we are, some data, but maybe we're not getting the results we want. So we can go back to that. But, you know, on the physical side, you know, ultimately everything it can be objective. You can measure pretty much every step, every lift, every action. And, you know, going back to that belief bit, you know, it was a very good way to help reinforce the team is on the right trajectory in terms of, well, look where we were physically in these key performance indicators. We know if we get them right, we've got a better chance of winning major tournaments. And the physical piece was easy. You know, is just put the work in. You know, the program's there for you. It's been diligently created by smart people. Put the work in and the results will be there. So on that performance chart, you can see that gap we wanted to close to the better teams, quickly closing, and even we're overtaking. So that was definitely like one motivation. And then, you know, the other areas you can see some objective indicators that you're getting better, but the physical one, you could make big impact super quick. You know, this is just about raw, hard, bloody work on the training ground, on the grass, in your own time. Whereas, as you know, like developing a style of play, developing a tactical structure, a chemistry, takes longer to see the evidence you're on the right track. So we decided to go down that route, which gave the players that belief and probably gave us more time in the other areas to grow them, knowing that our physical qualities were going to like bail us out at times where the other ones couldn't.
Yeah. No, and brilliant. I just looking at or thinking about, you know, these, it's both the women's and the men's game. It's still, you see the physical, you know, it's been proven every time. Even looking back to the men's game, and you look at teams like Morocco and the USA and all these developing nations, you know, they're doing it from a physical lens as much as they are from that tactical. So, you know, just emphasizing the importance of training and that, you know, the physical side is still very important. So, you know, actually making sure that you are training, you are working, and you are thinking about, if you're a young aspiring player, the player that you're going to be, versus the player that you are right at this moment. So I know we're conscious we haven't got too much time left, but, you know, just a contrast in terms of your career and working with players. So you've then gone into the men's game, you know, with Stevenage, assistant coach, manager at Stevenage, during your period and your time there. You know, just going back into, I'm not saying like a lower league team, but going back into, you know, that environment, how do you, what was the, I guess, the biggest differences, or how do you ensure that, you know, you, once again, you're effective, I guess, with that lower league team and those players?
Yeah. Look, I think it's where the change there is that, you know, at those levels, you've got a real mix in players. You've still got the high performance ones. You know, the ones who maybe their ability wouldn't allow them to get to the highest level, but in terms of their mindset, they are playing at the highest possible level their ability allows. You know, they are doing all the things that those elite players I talked about in international women's game were doing, but they just weren't as talented as what those athletes were. So you had those, the ones who, you know, maxing out, doing the right things. And then you had the other players then who probably absolutely had the talent and the ability and the tools to go and play at a far higher level, but just didn't want to have that high performance mindset. They didn't want to do the things that needed to be done to get up the levels. You know, they didn't want to turn up to pre-activation. They didn't want to, you know, do a recovery session. They didn't want to be at it in every single training session. They might train well on a Tuesday, but then not show up on a Wednesday or a Thursday for training. I don't mean physically turn up, but they'd be there present, but they're not committed to it. And then the gym work would be a token gesture. The diet would be, I'll eat well Monday and Tuesday, but then I fancy a pizza on a Wednesday. And that was difficult to, like, how do you bring that together? You know, how do you bring these players and people who are just relentless in what they want to do versus the players who really are just, I'm just here to take my salary. Or maybe they didn't know. You know, that famous line of, we don't know what we don't know. That, in fairness, is probably the case for a lot of these guys. They didn't understand what that mindset was that was holding them back. So you're trying to educate, support, manage that group, and also then you're back to the day-to-day, which is different. You know, like that level of football, you're playing Tuesday, Saturday, and you're looking to try and find ways to be competitive every single day, whereas in the international setting, you go for 12 days and then you have 20 days off. So you can actually be much more intense in that 12, demand much more in that 12 days than you probably can over a 10-month season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a couple of really, really good bits. It goes back to that, you know, that notion of, you know, if you want to be the best, you know, there's no such thing as a part-time professional. I think it's one of the older notes is like, actually, you know, if you want to be the best, you're going to have to turn up or at least have an awareness that you aren't. But then also the understanding of what is motivating players and groups. And that's going to be different. Like you mentioned before, some people, you know, don't want to be there and they're happy doing the level that they are and that side of things. And I guess who are we to try and actually, you know, we're going to try and motivate them to get best out of them because it's our job. But, you know, there's only probably so much you may well get out of them. Versus, you know, how do you maybe show players what is the gap, what is the difference, you know? I think that's really valuable advice. Just to wrap things up, I mean, there's been absolutely loads of gems throughout this. If there was one, I'm going to say one, if there's one real key piece of advice, you know, you're a young aspiring player, you know, to go put into your game tomorrow, like or tonight, if you're going to training tonight, what would that piece be?
Poof, I mean, look, it's tough, isn't it, to narrow it down? But look, let's go based on the last conversation. And I think as humans, we're products of our environment. You know, we have a natural way of just falling back to the norm. You know, if for example, the culture of the place you work is that we're meant to start at 9, but most people rock up a quarter past. Normally, 90% of people end up falling into line with the group and going, well, I used to think turn up at 9 was important, but it feels to me as though everyone else turns up a quarter past. So that must be the norm. So I think the example, you'd have heard this, is that I always remember hearing a story about Jessica Ennis. I'm trying to think of her full name now. Jessica Ennis Hill, now she is, I think, the triathlete, gold medal triathlete or heptathlete. And I remember she came into training to watch the team train. And within 5 minutes, she was just couldn't believe the level of standard of the warm up. And yeah, obviously for me, that was the norm. But then she talked about how for her, she set her own standards. So every calf raise, over the gate, high knee was to a maximum level. And when she goes in for a day, she wakes up in the morning and she's got her to-do list of what she needs to get to her best in that day. And a lot of time in football, we are reliant upon the coach. You know, we fall to the norm of the environment. If we turn up and the coach goes today, do you know what, guys, you can take it easy today, bit of five-a-side and then that'll do us. Well, that might not be what you as a player need to get to your level. So I think at every level, I would say that if you want to be the player that you want to be, you've got to set your own standards. You know, you've got to accept that you might not be normal within your group. You might be the one that stays after to do some running, that stays after some extra shooting, that turns up half an hour early to do some pre-activation, some stretching, and ask the coach, like, what are we going to do today, coach? And get in your mind about, well, if the team are doing some defending, but I'm a striker, What am I going to get out of that personally? And you might then become a bit isolated within that group at times. But I think accepting that if you want to be that as good as you can be, you've got to stand out from the crowd. That would be my advice. Be brave enough to like do more, demand more of yourself, and accept that people might look at you as the, why is he being busy? You know, why is he making us all look bad because he turns up early, we all turn up on time? Why is he always staying after training? Yeah, I think you've got to put yourself in that shoes, that uncomfortable situation where you're willing to do more based on what you need and what you want to get out of your career.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant advice. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for joining us. And once again, thanks to Connection Technologies for sponsoring the episode.